Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to The Athletic Football Show. I'm Robert Mays. Very excited about today's show. It's the third entry in our off-season interview series, and we get to talk to one of my favorite people to talk to, someone that has a deeper knowledge of football and the NFL than pretty much anyone you could stumble across, Wade Phillips. Wade, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, doing well. Thanks.
It is very good to have you on. You and I have talked about several things over the years. I always love picking your brain about stuff. But one thing we don't always get to talk about is you. And I remember a couple of years ago, before you guys played in the Super Bowl against the Patriots, I got to do a story that's one of my favorite things I've ever gotten to work on. And I went back through and I talked to, 20 guys that played for you over the course of your career. And I essentially asked them a very simple question. I said, what is your best Wade Phillips story? And it was a hoot. I mean, just an absolute riot, all the things they told me. But I haven't gotten to ask you about a lot of those things. So I'm actually very excited to get to ask you your take on some of those stories. The first one I wanted to ask you about was Earl Campbell told me this, and Steve Baumgartner confirmed it. When you guys were in Houston, I want to say, Willie Nelson, I want to say, came to an Oilers practice at one point. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did this happen?
Yeah, we were practicing. We had people show up at times at practice because we had on Saturdays in our home games, on Sunday home games, on Saturday we had, you know, walk through practice like everybody. But my dad invited families, children, dogs, you know, whoever. You know, there'd be a bunch of dogs out there barking and kids running around. And yeah, one day Willie Nelson showed up, and this is in the daytime, you know, and those guys are night owls. So, I mean, they were hardly woken up. And of course they're white as a sheet, you know, they don't have any sun. They don't get out during the day. So he came up, and then, you know, another one was Muhammad Ali came by one day. He was fighting.
Really?
Yeah, he was fighting in Houston, and he came by practice. And I mean, it was, in fact, one of the players, Curly Culp, kind of challenged him, you know, said, hey, show me what you got. And I mean, he popped him in the face like two times before he could even, and the whole team just fell out. I mean, it was just, it was amazing. Yeah. I went to watch him with a lot of people, but I went to watch him work out, and it was amazing what kind of workout he did. I mean, he was one of the hardest workers I've seen. You know, I don't know that much about boxers, but man, he went for an hour just straight, you know, boxing and in the ring and stuff, getting ready for the fight. Of course he won the fight, but yeah. And anybody wanted to come came. So we were lucky to see those guys.
And how old were you when you were on those Oilers, when you were coaching for those Oilers teams with your dad? How much older were you than Earl, for example?
Oh, we were similar age. I mean, I was 27 when I started with the Oilers.
So, gotcha.
And some of those guys, like Curly Culp and Elvin Bethea, were older than I was coaching, or older than I was. So, I just kind of jumped in there. And started with the linebackers, and I had Robert Brazil, who's in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to the defensive line with Elvin Bethea and Curly Culp, who are in the Hall of Fame. So I thought I was a heck of a coach. You know, anything I told those guys to do, they could do, you know. And I found out later on that every team didn't have those kind of guys. So.
Oh, you got pretty lucky, though. I'm pretty sure that if you were going to catch some breaks, I was looking through some of the numbers today. So there have been 8 guys that have won multiple Defensive Player of the Year awards in NFL history. Okay. You coached 4 of them.
Right.
6 guys won the Defensive Player of the Year while you coached them that season while you were their defensive coordinator. So it might have started off pretty good, but I didn't really tail off for the rest of your career in terms of the type of talent that you got to coach. I want to talk about that in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, because you were close to those guys in age, and you know, Andy Doris, who you coached with, I think the Saints, told me that you would often spend time with those guys. You'd play cards with them. You'd be around them. Do you feel like being that close to them in age and those experiences back then with your dad shaped the way that you wanted to treat players and the way you wanted to make connections with them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've always felt that way. And I've always told coaches that I've coached with or when I was a head coach, you know, go by and see them when they're, you know, when they're in the dressing room, you know, not just in the meeting rooms and when you're coaching them, but, you know, get to know them as people, you know, and I always, it helped me, it helped coaching them a little bit, but it really helped just life in general. I mean, you know, you learn to enjoy, you know, not only what you're doing, but the people you're working with. And they're not really working for you. They're working with you. So I always encourage that and I always try to do that. My dad, obviously, you know, my dad was one of the few guys, I'm sure, that the players called him by his first, called him Bum. You know, they didn't call him Coach Phillips. All the players called him Bum, you know. And I know Chuck Noll at Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh players weren't calling him Chuck. You know, they were calling him Coach Noll. You know, but he always had that openness that and they play, you know, you always want somebody to play hard. Well, you want them to play hard for somebody. And hopefully it's sometimes it's a coach, sometimes it's somebody in their family or they're close to. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Certainly that if a player liked you, you know, they used to think, well, if players liked you, well, then, you know, you weren't a very good coach. But you know, I always felt like, you know, I play harder for a guy I liked than I want a guy I didn't like. So,
do you think that made it difficult when you got to be a head coach because you had to be a little bit cold and calculating and you had to make some business decisions that were sometimes for the betterment of the entire team at the expense of guys that you had come to form relationships with? Remember, Simon Fletcher told me that sometimes the professional aspects of being a head coach weren't your favorite because you just had to do some things that if as a person you wouldn't want to do, but as a head coach you had to do.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more involved in being a head coach, certainly, than an assistant coach, you know. So, I mean, you know, picking the team and, you know, telling guys that, hey, that, you know, you can't make our team, but you still, you know, you still gave it the effort we wanted and those kind of things. So those are hard times, but, you know, anytime we cut a guy, I never felt like that was the end of his life. You know, I never was good enough to play pro football, and my life turned out pretty good. So, you know, I mean, I can think you can do it without being a pro football player or playing on that certain team. You know, you can have a great life. So
I got fired plenty of times.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't think it was the end of the world to tell a guy that, you know, somebody or we didn't think you were good enough for the team this year, you know, that kind of thing. So, because I didn't think it ruined their lives. Now, some of the guys that played pro football that were coaches, you know, they took it really to heart because they'd gone through it, I guess, you know, but I never got to go through it because I wasn't even good enough to play, you know. So, but that's the way it was.
I know you were on Chris Vasseur's podcast a couple months ago, and I really enjoyed it. You guys really dug into a lot of the schematic stuff that defined your defense over the years and some of the 3-4 elements that you'd use and some of the different adjustments you'd make against certain personnel packages, all of that. I wanted to ask you, when you guys, I looked it up today, and I want to say the first time you had the best statistical defense in the league when you were the coordinator was in with the Saints in like 1984.
Right.
How different, on day one of install, when you would sit there and draw it up, how different is the defense or the principles that you installed on the first day in 1984 and the first day in 2017 when you got to the Rams?
Well, I mean, there's more stuff because there's more offensive stuff.
Sure.
I first came in the league, they, you know, everybody, virtually every team was a two-back offense, you know, and we didn't see three wide receivers except on third down. So, I mean, so a lot of that certainly has changed because football has changed over the years. So, you know, we had to come up with more things defensively because they have more things offensively that you have to work out. The principles overall of the 3-4 pretty much, you know, stuck together. We've added zone blitzes and things like that that we didn't have when we first started. And, you know, I wasn't a coordinator at Houston, but, I mean, we had the same defense, you know. And it came from my dad overall. And so I added some basically as we went along as more things came up. And then really when I went with Buddy Ryan, that really helped me in that we were in a 4-3, but it was the Bear defense. Mm-hmm. And so some of the stuff – or a lot of this stuff changed or helped move to 3-4 defense, use the concepts, I'll say, of some of the Bear things. And that helped career-wise or defense-wise help my 3-4 overall was to have some of the Bear concepts that we added after I was with Buddy Ryan. So,
which ones would you say? Which ones would you think were particularly important that you feel like you took with you for the long haul?
Well, that we could get in a Bear front, you know, that we, I mean, it was easy to go 3-4 was a lot easier to go to a Bear front than a 4-3 because Buddy
just walk somebody down. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Buddy had to put the free safety down on the, you know, on the, or the strong safety down. I'm sorry. Strong safety down on the, as a weak side inside backer, you know? And so, you know, when you got a 3-4, you already got two inside backers already. All you have to do is bring the strong safety down on the line of scrimmage and you've got that same front. You go to a reduced front where you got 2-3 techniques, you know, but we do that some anyway. So, and then some of the concepts, the blitzes and things like that, we utilize from that.
Would you say that over time, one of the benefits of experience is just the deep knowledge of pressure packages that you can build? And I've listened to Dean Pease talk about that too. He's been around for a long, long time. And they're just such a deep bag that you can go into because you can say, oh, I use this in this way and, you know, 1988 and whatever, with whatever personnel we had, just because they're so situational that it feels like having a deep bench of them can be useful as you keep going in your career. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. I mean, yeah, experience certainly helps. I mean, whatever. And, having gone through not only things that were successful, things that weren't successful, you know, and say, I don't want to do that again, you know? So, yeah, we come up against things and then often, like I said, offense has changed. I mean, we went through the run and shoot area, a time where they were doing that, you know, we had to make adjustments to that kind of stuff, but you're always making some kind of adjustment and yeah, you keep those back in the back of your mind, and then something comes up that's similar. You say, hey, well, this is what I would do against it, this, and this is what I wouldn't do. And also personnel. I mean, you know, something against a great quarterback is different than something against a rookie quarterback, you know.
I wanted to ask you, with all those changes, the run and shoot, taking a fullback off the field and having 11 personnel now essentially be a base offense, what do you think was the biggest shift, the one that required the most thinking, the most changing on your part over the course of your career, the biggest offensive shift?
You know, when I first started, if they got in a slot, we thought they were, you know, put two receivers on one side and tight end on the other. We thought they were getting pretty versatile. You know, so, I mean, I started, and then what happened is they started putting a wide receiver in the backfield as a running back. And if you treated it as a regular offense, that, you know, that they could beat your linebacker one-on-one with that wide receiver. And then they finally just moved him out into 11 personnel, moved him out in the slot. But they just started with the guy in the backfield. So it changes as you go. You know, we're seeing a lot more of the jet motion stuff now, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's always something that's novel that comes up. But defense is really recognition. You can recognize plays. That's what you try to do. And whether defensive back or linebacker or defensive lineman, recognizing plays and, you know, that's the key. And so the more you see those things, the more you're able to recognize those. That's why defenses keep catching up with offenses. And then offenses have to come up with something else.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
What would you say when you were trying to deal with that influx of jet motion as it came about over the last, I don't know, 5-7 years, let's say? What was your thought process about it? What would you first think about it? How did you try to adjust? What makes it difficult to defend when you have all of that motion at the snap?
Well, in some ways it's good, because if you're going to blitz or things like that, you know, I always thought motion was good defensively, because then we know where the ball is going to be snapped. Mm-hmm. The jet motion stuff, you know, they get right to the tight end or the backside tackle and they snap the ball. So now they're starting, or at least Sean McVay did, he'd go jet motion and then walk out to another formation or jet motion back. So, you know, it keep progressing that way. But it's just motion, you know, it's just motion. You just have to do things quicker. You know, you have to make your adjustments quicker. And I think that's where they get a lot of people. Some people have so many adjustments that the jet motion really hurts them, because they got three different things that might happen and they can't get them called in time. So, but you know, we always had at least the players have to know what to do, you know? And so if it's motion or jet motion or whatever it is, they've got to be ready to change, and it's got to be a quick change. It's got to be good communication. And that's the key.
So you almost think that simplifying things and having the call be a little bit more static might be a good way to respond to that, just so you don't feel like you're scrambling and changing a bunch right as the ball is snapped.
Yeah, it's not simple. You have to say, hey, you know, for a man-to-man, we're going to do it this way. For zone, we're going to do it this way. But it can't be a giveaway as which one you're in. So, you know, that's where some of the things come up. But that was the same way. It's the same way with, you know, motion out of the backfield. You know, I mean, Tom Brady's done that for years, motion the back out of the backfield. Shanahan, his teams have done that. Mike Shanahan used to motion the fullback out wide to the weak side to see if you're in man or zone. So, I mean, that's always the case as far as disguise is concerned.
You mentioned Sean McVay, and I was listening to a podcast he was doing the other day, and he said something that you've actually said since we started talking. You said, you used to tell your assistants, you don't work for me, you work with me. And I think that's such a good way of putting it, and I find that so interesting. And that's easy when it's guys you've worked with before. You know, guys like Bill Johnson or Rick Kohler, guys that have been with you for years. But when you got to a place and you were with an assistant that you hadn't been with before, I'm thinking of somebody like Joe Woods in Denver or Aubrey Pleasant, Joe Barry in LA, guys who are now coordinators elsewhere. How did you fold guys in that you didn't know before and didn't have a deep knowledge of your defense? What is that process early on in the winter, in the spring, when you're trying to get them acclimated to what you want to do defensively?
You know, it's just like with the players. It's a little bit of a selling job, you know. I mean, you got to, you know, that's what it is. I mean, you got to let them know that, hey, this is going to be successful. Now, what I had going for me was I've been successful in a lot of places. So the players and the coaches that I coach with overall, when I came in, they thought, well, this guy really knows what he's doing, you know. So they kind of took it, you know, hey, what are we going to do and how are we going to do it? So I'd show them and they'd say, well, yeah, that's great. You know, I mean, because good coaches, you know, they know there's a lot of different ways to do things. And, you know, the guys you talked about, you know, and then you let them have participate, certainly, you know, and say, hey, this way we've done this. What do you think? You know, those kind of things. Again, working with a guy, but I went to San Diego with the Chargers and Pagano and Minuski were there. And they said, you know, I said, well, the calls Will Bullitt's cover too. And they said, okay, but what, you know, what's the defense? And I said, that's the defense. That's it, you know. So, because they hadn't heard it, you know, that simplified, I guess.
Yeah.
You have to sell people on what you're doing, the players certainly, but the coaches that you're coaching with, you know. And as you go into coordinator, you know, they expect you to say, hey, this is my defense, this is what I want done. But the teaching progression, I think, is the key, you know, to it, and say this is the way we teach things and this is how we get them done. And the fundamentals that we do are just as important as some of the X's and O's.
So I went back and I watched the 2015 AFC Championship game today because I was thinking about it for something else. I was like, oh, this is perfect timing. I'll go watch it and I'll check it out. And I was at that game. And my memory of it was that you guys just dominated them up front and that Brady was just running for his life and Vaughn and Malik Jackson had this monster game and they played well. But you guys were doing so many three-man rushes in that game. Vaughn had an interception on a fire zone where he was dropping into coverage. You guys mixed it up so much. And the game plan overall just, Brady was clearly uncomfortable. And it was really cool to watch because that so rarely happens. So I wanted to ask you, and I know you're not a self-aggrandizer, but is there a game plan or a game from your career that you're particularly proud of? Like one Sunday afternoon, we're like, you know what? We really did it today. Is there one that sticks out?
No, all the wins stick out.
Yeah. Among the wins.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that one, you know, we hit Tom Brady 24 times in that game. I mean, yeah. You know, and it wasn't me or my scheme. It was, you know, I do think we gave him some things he hadn't seen before and seen us play before. And I think you have to do that with the Mannings or Brady's or, you know, some of those guys, because, you know, they recognize what you do really quickly, no matter what. So we threw a few different things against them.
Like what? What were the kind of the wrinkles that you decided to unleash that day?
The three-man rush, like you said, three-man rush where we, you know, we dropped two guys in the zone, in the hook zone, and then I dropped Vaughn and from a 4-3 front, from a four-man front, and we dropped Vaughn in the, kind of the curl area, and that gave him a lot of problems because, you know, we were playing them in the game plan, certainly, was from the week before they played Kansas City, and they threw 35 passes 5 yards or shorter.
Yep.
I mean, they
yep.
killed them, but every play was 5-yard pass, you know. So we had to get some kind of underneath coverage that we could stop that, you know. We could cover man-to-man outside technique, but also have the guys inside playing zone, you know. But you had to have more people, so you couldn't rush four or five. So we tried to mix it up, and then we also played the things that we play well. Now, I mean, some of our cover two or whatever you want to call it, we covered eight at the time, and. You know, and cover six. We played some different coverages that we play all the time that we executed well too, you know. And we had a good rush no matter what. But we still had to intercept the ball with a 2-point play at the end of the game.
Yeah, I know. It was a tight game despite how well you guys played.
Yeah, yeah. And actually the game we played during the season at the end of the year there in Denver when we beat them, we probably played just as good in that game too. So we beat them in overtime. But the overtime game was they won the coin flip, and I saw Brady just jumping up and down over there. We won the coin flip. We're going to go down and score. And, of course, we sacked him and all the way back to the 8-yard line, 5-yard line, and they had to punt, and we got the ball on the, you know, 38-yard line, and CJ took it for a touchdown. So we played pretty well in that game too. But that team, you know, we beat Roethlisberger, and then, I mean, the Super Bowl now, we sacked Cam 7 times.
I remember. Again, I was there.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, we had some pretty good games, but it was we had some really good players too.
And that the three-man rush was an outlier because that year I remember specifically, you guys went to that five-man rush a ton. You guys just created one-on-ones across the board and essentially told Vaughn and DeMarcus and Malik, like, go for it. You're going to have one-on-one beat the guy across from you. Is that something that you just felt like if we create those one-on-ones, it's okay giving up a body in coverage because we feel like we're going to get there? Because it felt like that was a big staple of what you did later in your career.
No, we did that with the Houston Oilers too.
So. Okay.
And the Saints, we had Ricky Jackson of the Saints. And
I did not watch as much.
He was playing the Sam linebacker. And to get him to rush, you had to have a five-man rush. You know, you're rushing Will all the time, basically. Mm-hmm. So the five-man rush, we had to get him going. So it just depends on your personnel too, who you have. And you got to have guys that can cover. Now, we played a lot more zone at New Orleans. That was the amazing thing about that New Orleans team that led the league in defense was we played mostly zone because of our secondary guys, and we played matchup zone. It's probably as good as any team I've ever been around. I mean, because we played in the Dome Stadium, you know, in New Orleans, in that stadium. So the teams that play good pass defense are usually up north. You know, last half of the season, you can't throw it. I mean, the weather's too bad. But we had a great bunch with those guys, but it just depends on what your players can do too. I mean, we had some players that can do more. You're going to let them do more. You know, if you got some great rushers, you can better rush them. And you know, if you got two outside backers like DeMarcus and Vaughn, which one do you want dropping? You know,
I don't want either. Exactly. Why would either drop?
Yeah. I don't want them dropping or covering. I want them rushing, and so. Now, we ran some pseudo five-man rush in that we'd rush five, but one of them would be responsible for the back or have him, you know, pick up the back if you tried to check through and things like that. So, and we played a lot more four-man rush than people thought. I mean, people thought we rushed, you know, because our rush was so good. and of course, people think a five-man rush is a blitz overall, you know, and they say, well, you know, Wade's team, coming out of the dressing room, they're blitzing, you know. Well, we didn't – I don't know if we ran any all-out blitz, you know, maybe once or twice, but not very many times. Maybe on the goal line, but I always liked to get in the free safety in the middle just in case that somebody fell down or something.
So that day was against Brady. You played against Peyton Manning several times. You've done okay against Peyton Manning several times. I think you picked him off 4 times in Dallas in 2010. You know, he had some rough games against the Chargers when you were there. There was one, I think, big game that he had late in the season against you guys. But you have a ton of experience against both of them. I'm curious, when you were game planning for each of them, what was different? What different considerations did you have to apply to Peyton Manning than the ones you had to apply to Tom Brady?
Between the two guys or just both those guys? I mean, just
between the two guys. Because, I'm sure both of them, there's a lot, but I'm curious what's different about them in terms of game planning for them.
Yeah. Of course, Manning was always, he was going to always catch you if you change personnel, you know. So you had to worry about that with him all the time. And for a time there, they could change personnel. And if you change, you know, they could catch you. Now, then they changed the rule where the offense, had to give you time to change, to match up. But if you tried to change the packages, you know, people have so many packages and stuff. If you tried to change, he'd snap the ball and catch you with, 12 men on the field every time. So you could never do that against Manning. I think Brady just wanted to see what you had out there. Whatever you had out there, that's what he's going to do something against. Both of them are great at recognizing what you were in. You know, anything you give away, they they knew. And both of them after the snap knew what you were in anyway. So I think Manning was the best at between the two, was the best at audible in the running game. You know, he'd audible to a run, whereas Brady didn't. I mean, Brady had a pass call. He's going to throw a pass, basically. You know, Manning, if he had a pass call, he might audible to a running play. So you had to be careful with some of the zone or some of the zone blitzes and things like that, where you open on one side or the other. You couldn't do that against Manning because, you know, he'd run the ball on you. So, but both of them were so good at, and Philip Rivers was. Phillip Rivers was amazing too. I mean, you know, he would point at the strong safety and say, "Hey, you need to move over if you're going to blitz." He said, "You need to move over." You know, I mean, so you know, they know what you're in, you know, and they're hard to fool, and that's why you play something you hadn't played against them. But it's got to be something like you said. You got to pull out from your history of what you know what you think. Might be good against them, you know. It's still got to be sound, but it's got to be something they hadn't seen. And you know, they've seen almost everything, but they're so prepared against what you do and where you line up and how you do it. And the reason you're good is because you do it that way. But they're so good at recognizing that stuff that you have to give them something different.
So how do you balance that? Because I'm sure that your players aren't always comfortable if it's new. You don't know where the weaknesses are if it's new. So how do you try to strike that balance of saying, we're going to do something they've never seen because that's the best way to beat them, but we're also not as comfortable with it?
I mean, it's not every play, you know. You're still going to play your base stuff, you know, a good amount of the time. But your change-up defenses, you're going to play them a few times. You're not going to play them every down. He's the same thing. He's going to figure it out after a while. But I mean, you know, but the first time we drop Vaughn, you know, we get an interception. You know,
yeah, I didn't see it coming at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, that's where you gain some kind of advantage against those great, great players like that. But like I say, if we'd run that every down, he would just waited until people got open because of the 3-man rush. So we had to have a 4 or 5-man rush against him to pressure him, you know, to make him throw it. You still, even the great ones, I mean, you still got to put pressure on the quarterback. And the reason you get those interceptions or you stop them or make plays is not normally because you have great coverage, it's because you have great rush.
One of the cool things about that game specifically is that they were trying to do a lot of the same things they'd always done. They get a back or Gronk or someone matched up against a safety or a linebacker, an area they think they have a matchup advantage. And your guys that typically would be not cover guys, TJ Ward, Trevathan, Brandon Marshall, those guys showed up in a big way that day. TJ Ward had a one-on-one pass breakup against Gronk on the outside. I think Brandon Marshall had a pass breakup about 25 yards down the field on a slot fade. It's got to be nice over the course of a game when you see that even when they think they have matchup advantages, your guys are able to rise to the occasion the entire game.
Yeah, well, that defensive team was hard to get matchups on. I mean, they were so good.
It's very true. It's very true. Yeah.
I mean, those guys you talked about, they were good pass defense players. They just TJ was stronger in the run and great in added rush players. So we that's what he did well. So that's what we try to do with him. And then sometimes if we needed help, we would the outside backer would hit the back and then help Marshall or somebody like that. Trevathan was a really good man-to-man player, so we didn't have to give him much help. So it just depends on the player, you know, it's what you do with him, but. Like I say, it's the rush that makes the difference in when he has to throw the ball or how he has to throw it, and if he's under duress or if he's just sitting back in the pocket.
And even the threat of the rush, having it be in his head and having him have that internal clock get sped up a little bit, even if they're not getting there, I think the threat of guys like that always plays a part. I mean, just getting in the quarterback's mind, it influences the way he plays the game.
Yeah, and the two things you could do against those guys, you know, which you can't do against some, neither one of them could run. So,
yeah.
you don't normally rush and then rush inside, you rush outside. I'm talking about the outside guys, but you give them the freedom to go inside or outside against, you know, the guys that aren't runners, you know. So that's why Mahomes is so good, you know, and Rodgers. But those kind of guys, you know, they can not only throw it almost as good as those other two guys, but they can run with the ball, you know. And so they can make those plays that you know, those, you would never see Brady or Manning run for a first down, you know, against you. So, but those guys can do that. So you have to take advantage of that. I mean, you have to give them free rushes, you know, say, hey, I don't care where you go. You just beat your guy, you know. And then you have to, like you said, you have to get one-on-ones with your best players.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Everybody I talked to, whether it was Bruce Smith or JJ Watt or all of the guys that you coach, you gave them a ton of freedom. And that was a staple of your approach as a defensive coach. When you were thinking about guys like that, when you like stepped into the room with Aaron Donald for the first time, for example, is the ways you used JJ Watt and the backlog of experience you had with a guy like JJ Watt, did that inform the ways that you tried to use Aaron? Did one of them kind of help understand the other?
Well, like I said, I started out with some pretty good players, you know.
Yeah, even Reggie White, Yuri Bruce Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and did your experience with those guys help inform the way you wanted to use star players later on? Do you feel like they were similar enough?
Oh yeah, yeah. And you, like I said, I mean, if a guy's a great pass rusher, you got to get him one on one, you know, and that's whether it's an outside backer or D lineman or whatever. Even a nose guard, if you had a great nose guard that could rush the passer, you know, you'd reduce down to 2-3 techniques and make sure it's one-on-one with the center all the time. Mm-hmm. It's simple, but it's not, because so many people are so scheme oriented that we can't do, well, we don't do that, you know. So, well, yeah, but you got Aaron Donald, you better. You know. Of course, when I got there, you know, Aaron Donald was playing a 4-3 and he was the best three technique in the league, you know. I mean, in football, his best three technique. They said, well, you're coming in with a 3-4 defense, you're going to mess him up. And so what do we play him in a 3-4? Well, we played in the weak side three technique.
He played a decent amount of defensive end that year too, though, didn't he? I mean, you moved him around a lot, but just to get him matchups, right?
No. Yeah, we moved him around in our four-man front.
Yes.
Yeah, when passing downs. Again, matchups, and so they couldn't double-team him. We put him against the worst guard or center or guard, you know. We might put him against a tackle every once in a while, not much. But whichever the weakest interior lineman, the two guards and the center, on third downs, he's going to be against that guy. And we're going to make sure that he's one-on-one. That's I mean, that seems simple, but some people, you know, they're afraid to do stuff like that. I don't know why, because he plays this position and he has to do it this way. And this is the way we say, but I've always had more success with what they can do, not some kind of scheme that I thought was great on the board.
And you, the freedom you gave those guys, they always appreciated it. I think JJ especially has told me in the past that, you know, when he would go backdoor on certain plays and other coaches used to bitch at him, you would be okay with it as long as it worked, because that's the whole point. Were there guys among those star players that you had, was there anybody that you ever had to rein in a little bit where they weren't abusing that right, but they were taking it maybe a little bit too far every once in a while?
No, that's because those guys... The reason you let them do that is because they make the right decisions.
Yeah.
You know, the reason that you don't let other guys do that is they can't, number one, they can't do as much, but also they don't make the right decision. They go inside and the guy quarterback gets outside. But, you know, some of them Bruce Smith, I mean, God, the things we could do with him was amazing. And J.J. Watt, we audible defensive things where he would stunt inside or go outside on the formation. Now, how many defensive linemen know what the formation is? You know, well, he could do that, so we let him do it, you know. So those kind of things help. But it's what the guy can do, you know, and you have to know their weaknesses. You know, you have to know things that they can't do well. And I'm talking about every player on defense, but – I think that's what you do. And you say, hey, this guy can, you know, this guy's a great bump and run guy, but he's not a good off cover guy. I mean, you have to know those things, you know, as far as man to man I'm talking about. So you have to utilize those things. And then you get a great one that can do almost everything. What does he do best? Well, let's get him in that situation, or at least get him one-on-one.
I've tried to bait you into comparing those guys and some of those guys in the past, and you've always refused to do it, which I appreciate you. You're a man of character. But I wanted to ask you, is Aaron at this point, what you've seen from him over the last 4 or 5 years when you were with him and then even last season, do you think he's reached the same plane as guys like Reggie White in terms of being one of the greatest defensive players to ever play? Do you think he's on that level now?
Well, all those Hall of Fame guys are. I mean, gee.
See, you always do this. See,
well, I mean, they are. It's hard to say one Hall of Fame guy is better than the other.
I mean, I know.
Because their era and what they played in, and, you know, I mean, and I have said this, and I really believe this. Reggie White had the best season, one season that I've ever been around.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in 12 games, he had 21 sacks. Now, nobody's going to come close to that. I mean, that's an unheard of record that I don't think anybody could come close to, because we had a strike season and he didn't play the first four games, and then he gets 21 sacks. So I don't know anybody's had, and none of those guys have come close to that. I mean, they've all had 20 sacks, but not in 12 games. So that season was unbelievable by one guy. But all those guys, I mean, you know, I mean, J.J. Watt could be player of the year again. I mean, defensive player of the year this year too. I mean, that guy's a great player, you know? So, I mean,
People forget how dominant he was in like 2012, 2013, those couple years. I mean, he was unstoppable for those few seasons. I mean, it was on a level that I don't think people who weren't watching the sport closely appreciate now. I mean, obviously Aaron Donald and what he does is special, but those few years that JJ had, I think were just as dominant, just as impressive as the stuff that Aaron Donald is doing right now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what I say. Those Hall of Fame guys, it's hard to say one of them better at their peak than the other one. You know,
you've had plenty of them. I'm curious, not Hall of Fame guys, guys that you've coached that maybe don't get enough recognition. Is there somebody that you feel like over the course of your career, I'm sure there's plenty, but is there someone that sticks out that you feel like it was just criminally underrated, just consistently underappreciated that you were around?
Well, you know, Simon Fletcher was a heck of a player and had a lot of sacks when I was with him at Denver. And I don't think he got a lot of recognition for that. In fact, he didn't make the Pro Bowl one year, because we coached the Pro Bowl one year, and the outside backers, I told them, I said, man, you guys are lucky, Simon Fletcher, and they got mad at me because I told them Simon Fletcher was just as good as they were, but the Pro Bowlers. But guys like that, I mean, you know, I've been around, luckily been around a lot of good players. So, but, you know, it's not all, it's production, you know, and when they get, Merriman was a heck of a player, you know. I mean, he had 16 sacks in 12 games, so he didn't get 21, but he had 16, 12 games. But
Jamal Williams was great, too, on those teams. I think people forget about how good he was those couple of years that you had him there.
Oh, yeah. He was outstanding. Plus, he was amazing. He knocked down more passes than anybody taller. 6'1" than anybody I've ever been around. So I use him as an example of how to do it, because, you know, he could do that besides just overpowering the center every play. He was a great one too.
When you were installing defense with the Rams, what was the oldest clip on your teach tape? Like, how far back did it go? Any of the examples?
We still call everything, you know, Sam, Mike, Mo, and Will, you know. Now it used to be Sam, Mike, Meg, and Will, and then our inside backer didn't want to be called Mo. I mean, he wanted to be called Meg, so we called him Mo. and then we had a weak safety, and our safety didn't want to be called weak safety, so we start calling him free safety.
These are the things you don't think about as a coach when you're talking to players. They don't want to be weak, and they don't want to be Megs.
That's right. So, but you know, all our terminology stuff is pretty close to the same from when I first started, because it was simple enough to know. You know, Sam is always on the tight end. Will is always on the open side. Mike is always inside with the Sam on the same side. Over the guard, and then Mo is always with Will all the time, you know. And call Sam and Will, and they know Sam, the three linemen know Sam and Will. It's called Sam and Will are rushing, and Mike and Mo are covering. It's called Mike and Mo, then Sam and Will are covering, and Mike and Mo are rushing. Or if you just call one of them, call Mike Rush, within the three other three guys cut a cover. So, I mean, it's always worked. And we try to make it not simple, but try to make it fit where the players know what to do. I mean, people just they go overboard on, you know, changing this guy and that guy and changing the rush when they motion and things like that. And you make more mistakes, and the more mistakes you make, the bigger chance you got to get beat. So we try to the teaching progression, I think, is the best that we've had over the years, is the best, because we've been able to go in the first year and change defenses from, like, the Texans from 31st to 2nd, you know, those kind of things. So that makes me feel like that, look, you know, now they weren't good. That's why I came in, because the team wasn't good, you know, the defense wasn't good.
Well, you also got a number 99 your first year there as a rookie that ended up being pretty good. So that it helps when the players get better too.
Oh yeah, we traded. Yeah, we got Johnson Joseph. We picked up on free agency and Daniel Manning in the secondary, because we had a bad secondary, so we brought those guys in. And Connor Barwin, we moved outside backer in a 3-4. He was a dominant player. So it's still players that you get. It wasn't me, but we still won games and played well in the first couple of years. So. Which made me think, hey, we're not making – and that's part of what we've always done, is said, hey, we don't make mistakes. You know, when people – I mean, our tolerance for mistakes is zero. And there's no tolerance for mental mistakes. Well, those mental mistakes, we're the teachers. I'm talking about the coaches. Mm-hmm. So if they're making mental mistakes, it's our fault. So we need to remedy that, you know. So that's why we say, you know, we get them to believe, hey, we're not going to make any mistakes, but we're not going to make any mental mistakes. And that means if they're running jet motion and you have to change three different things, you might not get them all changed. So you better have one way to do it and how you do it. Now, you might change it from week to week, you know, but people don't realize that it's a game of mistakes. And the more mistakes you make, the less chance you ever win it.
Awesome. Wade, thank you very much for doing this. Thank you very much for taking the time. It's always good to chat with you. You're doing a new podcast with your son, Wes, called Overtime. So people should definitely go check that out if they haven't. You guys, I'm sure, will be talking about all kinds of different stuff. Your son is an assistant with the Rams. So that is definitely something people should listen to.
Yeah, we started it. We just dropped one so far, but we're going to talk about, you know, the Dallas Cowboys and the Denver Broncos and the Houston Oilers and the Eagles and Chargers and Buffalo. You know. I can talk, you know, on all these teams I've been with, and then my dad, obviously, talking about him, and then Wes. You know, Wes has been in the league like 14 years now, so. I mean, there's a lot of things I think people would be interested in. Wes is a tremendous moderator. I'll say that for him so far. He does a good job. But I think it's worth listening to. I think people enjoy it.
Awesome. Well, Wade, thank you very, very much for the time. It's great to chat with you. I'm sure we'll catch up down the road. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Always great talking to you because you talk football, Robert.
You know what? Anytime. You know I'm always down to do it. I'll talk to you soon for sure.
Okay, good.
All right, see you later, Wade. All right, guys, that's all we got for today. Thank you so much for stopping by, and thank you to Wade Phillips for his time. So much fun to chat with him. Always an absolute legend. One of my favorite people to have a football conversation with. I'm glad you guys got to be in on it this time. We'll be back tomorrow with Nate. We're going to do something about the best offenses in the NFL last year, just kind of the lessons we learned from digging in and rewatching some of them, which we've both been doing over the last few days or so. We'll also have another edition of the interview series next week with an NFL head coach, which I'm very much looking forward to. I hope you guys are as well. In the meantime, please rate and review the podcast. You guys have been doing better, which I really appreciate it, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you guys listen. Also, please subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/football show. I have a piece out today about the Bucks and how they ran it back with all 22 starters. What that means based on recent history, and whether that gives them a better chance, theoretically, of repeating, which no team has done in a very, very long time. We'll be back tomorrow with Nate. Until then, thank you guys for listening. Talk to you soon.
This was The Athletic Football Show.